This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. There's a lot of nostalgia for the 1990s these days. The economy was on the upswing, the music industry, publishing industry, and newspaper business all in great shape. And for a moment, it looked like the triangle might be the next big thing in popular music. It was a good time to be playing music here in the area, and one local guy who gained international success was Ryan Adams. Today we're going to take a look at the triangle music scene in the 1990s and how Ryan Adams shaped and was shaped by this particular scene. David Menconi is music critic for the News and Observer. His new book is called Ryan Adams, Losering, A Story of Whiskey Town, and he joins us today. Welcome back, David. Good to have you here.
Great to be here.
So, David, there is a universe of people for whom Ryan Adams is a legend. There is another world who's never heard of him. So, you know, give us a sketch.
Well, he is a very fine singer-songwriter, and he's somebody whose exploits in many minds outweighs his music. There are people who don't really listen to him. The only thing they know about him is he threw a fit on stage at the Ryman Auditorium for being mistaken for Bryan Adams once by a heckler. Not mistaken, but needled. Yeah. And, he sort of left a trail of stepped-on toes, you might say. But for all that, he really is one of the finest singer-songwriters of his generation.
And as you say, the quintessential rock star in a lot of ways, albeit the 1990s version of that.
Absolutely. And there are other acts that have come out of here that have sold a lot more records, but nobody that has ever played the part as adroitly as he did.
So you talk in the book about your first interview with Ryan Adams. Tell us that story.
Well, it was at a little joint in downtown Raleigh called the Berkeley Cafe, which is still there, and I sat down to interview him. It had been a really great show, a singer-songwriter, solo acoustic kind of thing, him and four other people. And a drunk went crazy and started making threats and took the place hostage, and they had to call the cops in there to drag him out in riot gear. That was the first and last time I've ever had an interview called on account of third-party psychosis.
You literally were actually thrown out of the place while the cops were doing their intervention for
several
hours.
That is true, yeah. And, you know, the interview was wrecked, but it was worth it. I mean, that's just a priceless story, and it made sense to kind of open the book with that scene.
And your sense of the music. You went in not knowing too much about this guy and were pretty impressed at what you heard.
I really, really was. I had seen one of his earlier bands, Patty Duke Syndrome, whose recordings I quite like now. I'm embarrassed to admit they really hadn't made that much of an impression back then at the time. Just another band. I might have caught him on a bad night. I look at YouTube clips and wonder what the heck I was thinking, how I missed that, but I did. So, Whiskey Town was on the rise. I'd heard some recordings quite like them, and then I was just kind of blown away by him and his presence and how good he was, and also how young. I mean, he could have passed for like a high school underclassman back then.
Well, he practically was. Came from Jacksonville, right? Dropped out of school. Give us the backstory.
He grew up in Jacksonville, which he referred to as an oppressive town with a military base. And if you're a townie down there, your prospects are few. And he decided music was going to be his way out, and it was. And he, at a certain point, decided it was time to run away from home, and Raleigh was the biggest, you know, city, I guess, right up the road, biggest, closest city. Mm-hmm. So that's where he went.
Came here to make music. And paint the picture for us. Give us the soundscape of Raleigh in kind of the mid-1990s. Things were kind of booming here for music.
They were. I got here not too long before that myself, 1991, the year punk broke, as they put it. Nirvana blew up that year, and all of a sudden, the industry was looking for the next indie rock gold rush town. And for a while, it looked like Chapel Hill might be it. Chapel Hill was kind of the stand-in for the entire triangle. Whenever magazines like Spin or the New York Times would come in, they'd invariably date the story Chapel Hill, even though Raleigh and Durham were a part of it too. But there was a lot of really good underground kind of alternative rock bands of the sort that probably would have not caught attention a few years earlier, but did after Nirvana.
So let's get a sample of that. We'll just choose Archers of Loaf here performing Web in Front.
Stuck a pin in your backbone, spoke you down from there. All I ever wanted was to be your spine. Lost your friction and you slid for a mile. Overdone, overdrive, overlive, override. You're not the one who let me down. But thanks for
Sisters of Loaf, Web in Front, the triangle version of that music of the 1990s.
Indeed. Them, Superchunk, Polvo, Motorola was another. All sort of, you know, you could imagine them on a bill with Nirvana, say. And there was a time when record labels were coming around, and none of those bands really broke through, but they certainly kind of created a very fertile scene that Ryan arrived in the midst of.
And how much of that scene was strictly derivative, trying to sound like Nirvana or Pearl Jam, or how much of it was, what did they bring to it? What does the triangle add to that sound?
Well, I'm sure they would all take issue with being told that they were trying to sound like anybody, but, you know, it was their own kind of spin on it. This wasn't the only place this was going on. You know, the thing about college towns is there's an endless supply of kids coming in, and bored kids tend to start bands. And at a certain age, your concerns tend to be, you know, fairly universal for young people. So, you know, fast, dirty, punky kind of pop is what they all did. And there's a sort of odd, angular pop sense that I think bands from this area have always had. It's hard to put your finger on, but it's a strain that's there.
Well, it had to be something because, as you say, the critics were coming here, the scouts were all coming here. I mean, give us a picture of what that was like and why they would – I mean, there are college towns all over America, presumably recreating this, some version of this everywhere. Why was it that Chapel Hill kept popping up in the magazines?
I think one reason was the band Superchunk, who were really, really kind of at the top end of that scale. And at that time, too, they were about to become available. They were signed to a big indie label out of New York called Matador. And when their deal was up, they were going to have options. And the Sonys and Interscopes of the world had designs on them. So, yeah, they came in, and then there were all these other, you know, bands of similar ilk. So, yeah, I think that had a lot to do with it.
So just to give you a sense of what we're talking about here, here's a little sample of Superchunk right now. Superchunk Precision Auto, of course, we know. Superchunk went on to the founders of that band created their own record label. Merge Records are doing pretty well these days.
They are, as is Superchunk. They're still at it. You know, I don't think they don't do the kind of road warrior lifestyle they used to, but they still get out and play, and they did a record within the last couple of years, and there will be more, and still flying the flag.
You know, it's interesting, too, if you think about Merge and that phenomenon. Being on the threshold, this will get us to Ryan Adams in just a minute, but I want to paint the picture of signing the big contract, getting the big deal in L.A., and they don't. They somehow turn back from that. That's one choice that a lot of local groups have made, which gives, I think, this area the characteristic sound it has. Bands stay here.
They do. There's always been a very solid working-class DIY tradition to North Carolina music. This is something I've written about before. I think it's a short step from the blues guy who works in a tobacco warehouse and picks a little guitar to fish fry on the weekend as a hobby, and a punk band that's, you know, holding down day jobs and putting out their own record. There's a very similar strain running through both of those.
So where does Ryan Adams and his sound fit in that soundscape?
Well, he was more of kind of an indie rock sort of guy when he showed up here, and the early bands that he played in were a lot like that. The aforementioned Patty Duke Syndrome that were a lot like Replacements. And he came and went through a series of bands, some of them very, very short-lived, and finally hit upon Whiskey Town. He told somebody back then that he was going to start a country band because punk rock was too hard to sing. Which is a line that actually turned up in, you know, their first single not too long after that.
Punk was too hard to sing, and yet he had the quintessential voice. I mean, that was the voice.
That's a tribute to his ability, which is almost chameleon-like. I mean, he can hear any record or song, it seems like, and reproduce the vibe, if not necessarily the exact sound of it, very quickly. People who have been in bands with him before have all remarked on this.
Let's get a sample of Whiskey Town performing the song Angels Are Messengers from God.
Been living on faithless streets. for unsanctioned Christ above man. He never shed his peace on this land. So I started this damn country band. 'Cause punk rock is too hard to sing.
Go Whiskey Town. Angels are messengers from God. Talking today to David Menconi, author of Ryan Adams Losering, a story of Whiskey Town, the story of Ryan Adams, mostly his time here. So that gets back to something else you talk about in this book, which is here's a guy who tried to emulate the rock star, not only in the bad boy behavior, but kind of in everything he did.
Yeah. He seemed to get early on that there's a way of carrying yourself if you're going to live that life. And, it would sometimes manifest itself as a silly rocker costume when you go around with lots of rings and beads and stuff and look sort of like Keith Richards. But, there was always sort of a swagger about him. And it wasn't just on stage. It was often just, watching him.
He also applied for a job at your workplace, right?
Yes, indeed. the story goes that he was working at Joe's in downtown Raleigh, a diner, which is right across a park from the News and Observer. And someone at the News and Observer, a female worker, he took a shine to, so he applied for a job there as a copy boy. I asked around, and I have my suspicions who it might have been, but I was never able to definitively determine who that might have been.
That's I hear how everybody really starts out at the NNO. They just see somebody who looks good, and then they get a job there. Is that true?
Yeah, pretty much. We're all just trolling for babes one way or another.
that's kind of what I've heard. But you've got his letter, which I think is kind of interesting, and you include that in there, his part of his application letter. Would you read that for us?
Yeah, this is only a part of the whole thing, which can be found online. It is an amazing document, but this is kind of the closing stretch of it. And keep in mind, this is a job application. There comes a time when old acquaintances must be forgotten, when the party's over, when the fat lady has just about let out those first few repulsive notes, and it is finally obvious that action must be taken. Of course, now what? What does the idealist pursue in modern-day society? More likely, what in the hell am I to pursue in modern-day society? Flat broke from the listless night spent crooning life over a bottle of strong liquor, using my youth as a weapon against the world and myself, taking advantage of life at all costs, at any means, and most definitely every waking hour. I imagine I shall pursue the same direction as I always have, maybe this time with more self-discipline. I have escaped every other form of discipline save the bad luck and hard knocks that one comes across alone and against the world once and for all. Even in failure, I will still be at work, as restless as before, as willing to submit only to the deepest of my whims.
There we go. David Menconi reading from part of the application letter that Ryan Adams wrote to the Raleigh News and Observer trying to get a job. Well, I mean, hard liquor and disillusionment, that's newspaper.
Oh, yeah.
But seriously, the thing about him is, it seems to me, and this comes through and you write about this in your book, he is raw emotion and he knows that. And he talks about being an introspective guy who's going to just express the emotion he feels, whether it's a job application or country song or a punk song.
He can't hold anything back or it's extremely difficult and he often chooses not to, at least in my experience.
What about the people who played with him, the people in Whiskey Town, for instance, and in other bands? What was he like as a bandmate?
Difficult. A consistent underlying theme there. You hear lots of people talk about how difficult it was. And in fact, in Whiskey Town especially, people came and went just constantly.
And of course, you had a very close relationship with him from the beginning. And you talk about the fact that at a certain point, you were doing de facto PR because all of your reviews ended up in their promotional material.
Yeah, it did kind of lapse into propaganda at times. I mean, I just loved them so much. There was a line there that I felt like I didn't cross. I mean, I was very close to the band and the music, but I wasn't generally palling around with them very much. It's a hard line to know where to draw in the local scene, especially with a band you just really love.
What about that sound that they created in Whiskey Town, that kind of alt country? Where was that on the landscape nationally? Was it on the rise? Where were we?
Well, it sure seemed like it was on the rise in the mid-90s. There was a generation of bands that, you know, had been playing sort of variations on college radio type alternative rock that, you know, got twangier. There was the Jayhawks in Minneapolis. There were the Uncle Tupelo spinoffs in St. Louis, Sunvolt and Wilco. There were various bands in Texas. And around here, there was a real good crop of bands like that. Whiskey Town, The Backslider, Six String Drag. No Depression Magazine, which was kind of the Bible for this particular sort of music in the mid-90s. The co-editor, Peter Blackstock, did a column calling North Carolina the home base of the style in 1996.
So, how much of that had to do with the breakdown of other bands? You mentioned Sunvolt, Wilco, the sort of the spinoffs, and he was one of them. How much of his success do you think, and Whiskey Town's success, owes to the breakup of their original band?
Uncle Tupelo, you mean?
Yeah.
I think there was I think that had an effect on him going in this direction. That's, you know, he did not unfortunately cooperate on this book, and that would have been an interesting thing to talk to him about. But in this, you know, in 1994, when Whiskey Town was kind of coming together, Uncle Tupelo had broken up kind of in a tidal wave of bad vibes, and it seemed like there was a void there.
And, of course, that was a band that had come, at least in the alt-country world, to a lot of people's attention. So, A, you notice that they're not around, and so obviously there's a hole to fill, as you said. Mm-hmm. You think it was that – and then everybody, of course, the critics are all looking for the next Uncle Tupelo.
Indeed, indeed. And, you know, here's where it gets a little dodgy because I was part of that. You know, I was writing for No Depression. A lot of what I wrote about Whiskey Town and about Ryan was in No Depression, as well as the News and Observer and various other places. So it's odd to kind of report on that and theorize about it when, I participated in that.
You're part of that scene. Well, what's that like to be, in a sense, associated with a rising star? In some ways, yeah, what you say about him can help and can help that star rise, and then, of course, be associated with him later on and be the guy who was there when.
Well, you know, it was a very different era. The internet was just kind of really taking shape, and there was still more consensus. It was already kind of falling apart. But, you know, the daily paper had a different and more prominent place than it does today. You know, now I'm just one voice among many. But, yeah, you know, you do assume a strange sort of ownership. That might not be the right word, but... But yeah, you know, there's that almost famous thing where you're kind of pulling for people and you feel like you can be a part of that.
So what was happening to Ryan as he was getting more national attention?
Oh, you know, just I don't think he got any easier to deal with. He got a little bit more remote, but yeah, it put a little more giddy up in his swagger, I think.
And how about the music? Did it change that much?
Yeah, it did. It got more polished, slicker, to some ways of thinking worse, but I think his best record is still Whiskey Town Stranger's Almanac, and that's one of the most polished records he's ever made.
On the State of Things Today, talking to David Menconi, the music critic for the NNO. His new book called Ryan Adams, Losering, A Story of Whiskey Town. Up next, we'll talk about Ryan Adams' meteoric rise to fame. Talk about it on the State of Things. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today talking about Ryan Adams and the triangle music scene in the 90s. David Menconi, music critic for the NNO. His new book, Ryan Adams, Losering, A Story of Whiskey Town. How do these bands form? Well, let's take Whiskey Town. Does he put them together? Do people find him?
Well, he was working at a place in Raleigh called Sadlax, and it came together as a group of employees from there.
You just get a bunch of guys from the kitchen, hand them an instrument, and get up on stage.
That's pretty much the way it happens.
Got together. And a good band. I mean, let's once again, you know, just to give you an idea, we'll get a sample of their sound. Here's Whiskey Town again.
Midway Park. Streetlights shine on a road that is dark. Down on the grid.
That's Midway Park, Whiskey Town. By this time in their career, that's from which album now?
That was Faithless Street, their full-length debut.
All right. So at that point, this is the album that's bringing them to anybody's attention, or did anybody notice that album nationally?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I wouldn't say it sold terribly well because it was on a very small local independent label with rather spotty distribution. But it definitely got attention in all the right places media-wise, just in terms of awareness within the industry. Record labels were coming around very soon after that.
Tell us about the album Stranger's Almanac.
Well, that was the first one they made after signing with the major, which was kind of a tortured process in and of itself. But that was a record where everything kind of came together. Remarkably, it was really had a difficult birth. It was a very chaotic situation. The songs, Ryan had written a bunch of brand new songs on the way to the studio, and they weren't recording what they thought they were going to record. So there was a lot of uncertainty. The producer was a real taskmaster. He kind of kicked everybody's butts, especially Ryan's. And it turned out just amazing. It just sort of is a statement of purpose about who he was and where he came from. I've always thought of that as one of the definitive Raleigh records.
Was that maybe his MO? If he's not working against something, then he's not doing his best work?
That certainly was the case back then. And that would explain why his work sounds a little more comfortable and a little less, to my mind anyway, compelling.
Yeah. And that, of course, this was the time, I mean, the kind of the last hurrah for the big record deal too, really.
It really was, yeah. Whiskey Town came along kind of at the last gasp of that, the bidding war era, as it were. Another 5 years after that, and they were all starting to fall apart at the seams.
So how did Whiskey Town fall apart?
Well, it's funny. The industry falling apart had something to do with that. Their label was bought and dissolved in one of these corporate mergers, and their third album, called Pneumonia, sat on the shelf for a couple of years. So they were in this strange limbo, and meanwhile, Ryan, being a restless guy, he went out and made a solo record. Caitlin Carey started her own thing too, and eventually it just made sense for them not to continue anymore.
And his solo career, was he already in the limelight? Did he have to bring more attention to himself?
Oh, he was in the limelight, but he certainly hit a new level with it pretty quick with his first solo record, Heartbreaker, which set the stage for Gold, which was kind of his mainstream breakthrough.
So let's take a listen now. Here, Ryan Adams. Here he is performing Come Pick Me Up, Ryan Adams.
I wish you'd make up my bed so I could make up my mind. Try it for sleeping instead. Maybe you'll rest sometime. I wish I could. Wish I could. I wish I could.
Come Pick Me Up, Ryan Adams. I'm talking with David Menconi, author of Ryan Adams' biography, an unauthorized biography, Ryan Adams Losering, A Story of Whiskey Town. I mean, is he the same guy? Is he the solo version of Whiskey Town? How does he change as a solo artist?
Well, no. You know, in Whiskey Town, he had more people he had to answer to. As a solo act, not so much. And, it's sort of a fine distinction because in Whiskey Town, he wrote the vast majority of the songs. He was the lead voice on almost all of them. He was clearly the focal point. And yet, it wasn't necessarily a band of equals, but it was closer to that than him as a solo act.
He talked about Gold being the breakout album, but everybody else seemed to love it except you.
I did not. I was not alone in that, but that was certainly a minority opinion. My feeling was if Gold was the first thing of his you heard, you'd probably be pretty impressed. If you were familiar with some of what came before, you were kind of shaking your head at why so many people seemed to think this was so great. I felt like Gold was just kind of messy and self-indulgent, and it didn't sound like nearly as much was at stake with that as what he'd been doing just a year or two before.
And it sounds like he took it personally.
It seems like it. At a certain point, he and I came to a parting of the ways, and I'm still not entirely sure what about, but my opinion of Gold probably had something to do with it. I wrote a less than flattering review in the newspaper, my first of his. It's probably the worst review I've done of anything he's done. I just didn't much care for it.
And he wrote you a note, I think. You have it. You kept the email. Maybe you can read that for us, where he expresses some of his dissatisfaction.
That was actually in response to a long profile I'd done about a year or so before that. But he didn't much care for that story either. Anyway, this was an email I received, ironically enough, on September 11th, 2000, 1 year to the day before the terrorist attacks. I am very angry with you, but only out of love. I've discovered that you don't know me very well. It isn't even important. You are much more beautiful without me to consider. I'm drunk and in Seattle, and I just went to a spiritualist guide. They call him a shaman. And my life is changed, hard changed. I hope to think about you in my meditations. Peace and cookies, R.
That's an email by Ryan Adams to my guest, David Menconi, who wrote the unauthorized biography, Ryan Adams Losering, A Story of Whiskey Town. Did he write like that frequently, just sort of drunk and shoot off emails?
Oh, yeah. Some of the emails that I got, I didn't keep them all, but I kept some of the more entertaining ones, including that. And kind of a serial poster, too, various mm-hmm. online groups and forums and whatnot. He left a long electronic trail, you might say.
Talk about 9/11, too, and that sort of inadvertently also played into his career, didn't it?
It did. 4 days before the terrorist attacks, a video was shot for his single, New York, New York, off Gold, and he was across the river playing the song Under the Brooklyn Bridge with the World Trade Center towers in the background.
Yeah, and that kind of makes it round. So how about for you writing this book? I mean, he didn't want to see it come out. He didn't want to see you write it, and apparently told his friends the same thing.
Mm-hmm. I had some back and forth with his representatives and was made to understand that he would not be participating. So I proceeded, basically I was going to be using old interviews from back in the day, which was, appropriate, given that was the focus of it, and secondary sources from then and now. I talked to some bandmates. There were some people in his circle that I wanted to interview who wouldn't if he wasn't going to participate. But plenty more who did, quite frankly. It really wasn't that much of a problem. I felt like I got more than enough voices, more than enough data in there to tell the story.
Well, you talked about Gold and that album that you were not particularly fond of, but critics, and as you point out, people who had maybe not heard what he had done before kind of thought this was great. Let's hear a little sample of that now.
Found a lot of trouble out on Avenue B, but I tried to keep the overhead low. Farewell to the city and the love of my life, as we left before we had to go. Love won't play games with you anymore. Don't want them to. Sweep a sheet, so thing at the door. I'll always be thinking of you. I'll always love you, though, New York. 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 New York, New York.
Ryan Adams, New York, New York. How do you think that song might have done had it not been for?
Well, it wasn't a huge breakout hit. I mean, you did hear it a good bit that fall, like on bumper music, on TV shows and things like that. But it never made the Billboard Hot 100 or the Top 40 or anything like that. But it did get a lot of attention, kind of almost as the theme song for everybody's healing up that year. It's actually kind of ironic that he didn't explode bigger than he did, quite frankly. He sold a good amount of records and did pretty well, but just based on how omnipresent he suddenly was, though, I mean, every magazine, it seemed like, every newspaper he was in, you'd expect him to be double or triple platinum at least, and not quite gold is where he wound up.
Of course, the title of the book is Whiskey Town, or A Story of Whiskey Town, and you kind of end your book there. We don't follow him too much into his solo career.
Yeah, the closing stretch of the book kind of, goes over the last decade from a distance, you know, because I didn't have my front row seat anymore. I have some thoughts about his last 10 years of records and whatnot, and just from the perspective of somebody who was there at the beginning.
Well, that is an interesting perspective in a way, and you talked about it with respect to your reaction to Gold. The idea that if you've been following a career, and this is kind of a professional consideration as a critic, you can't help but compare an artist to what they've done before, particularly if you've heard them in clubs. I mean, it's not just their records. You have a broader sense. Do you wonder about that as a critic when you're only listening to records? Do you ever think to yourself, gee, I wish I could have been in this guy's town and
watch him all the time. You know, it's a privilege and a burden both when you're there from the very beginning, because you do wind up with this somewhat warped set of, I don't know if expectations is the right word, but, you know, you feel like you know, you want to feel like you know what's best. And, you know, I would not be so arrogant as to claim that, you know, I should have the power of telling him what to do. And yet, you know, I feel like a lot of what he's done hasn't lived up to the best of what he can do. That's kind of all I ever wanted for him was really to hit the heights I knew he could.
I suppose you get a sound in your ear. It's kind of hard to wash that out in some ways too.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's one thing to objectively measure his career, and how would you gauge his career at this point? You know, where is he now, and what's the future?
Well, he has a career most people would dream about. You know, I mean, he can go around selling out 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 seat halls all over the world just as much as he wants, whether or not he's got a new record out. He's got enough celebrity to know he probably doesn't want more of it. Being married to a movie star has turned him into a paparazzi target now. He's married to Mandy Moore, the former teen actress, and they're recording together, in fact. But, you know, he's in a very comfortable place, and he's done some good work. Ashes and Fire that came out last year was quite good, I thought. You know, he does seem susceptible to lack of focus. I mean, lately he's been producing Mandy Moore. Suddenly there's word that he's playing drums in the Lemonheads reunion and producing their record. It leaves you wondering, you know, what path is he on, and will he bear down and focus on it, on what it, you feel like he could do best?
What do you think it is that drives him? Is it to be a rock star? Is it the fame? Is it the art? What drives him?
Well, he does genuinely love music, by all appearances. You know, I expect that has ebbed and flowed over the years. But, yeah, his enthusiasm for the art, for the music, and the history of it was just so contagious. Somebody I talked to, one of his former bandmates, likened him to Peter Pan when they met for the first time to talk about putting a band together, the way he'd kind of float around the room, climbing on things. You know, it was almost manic, and it was kind of charming, too. You know, I think a strain of that is probably still there. I've not been around him in a good long time. You know, I think it best case scenario, best interpretation, is that he looked at the stardom part of it, as fun as it was, as a means to an end to get to play the music.
Of course, you did know him. We talked about that early in his career. So you've got an idea who this guy is. What were the surprises for you in putting this book together about Ryan Adams?
Well, you know, I had always assumed early on that, well, gosh, he must have really grown up as a, you know, playing country music, really steeped in that life, because he did it just so convincingly. And that wasn't really the case. I mean, he had kind of a typical American, middle America type upbringing, it seems like. And country music was part of what he was exposed to, but it's not like he grew up on a porch in Appalachia or anything like that. He could just do everything so convincingly that he could convince you he'd been playing that and nothing but that forever. But no, there were many, many different things he was doing. And getting to hear some early tapes of his and how good he was as a raw teenager was also really
something. And it's interesting that he can be so good at music and so good at imitating at the same time. I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's kind of the fascinating thing about this guy. He could be a chameleon, and yet he always brings something new, or often brings something new to his music.
Yeah, and from the get-go, he really knew how to play the part. One of my favorite parts of those early tapes is him at a rehearsal that they recorded asking his bandmate, "Do I sound like I mean it?" And you could just almost picture the look on his face when he's asking that, and he just sounds so eager and so into it and so convinced, you know.
David, fun book. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
David Menconi, music critic for the NNO. His new book, Ryan Adams, Losering, A Story of Whiskey Town. Thanks for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.